Welcome back to the program. We've talked many times on this program about the obligations and responsibilities of memoir and the way in which our memories, more often than our truth, shades our past. Imagine if fiction took on this confusion. If even in the context of fiction, we lose sight of the truth in favor of memory, experience, and peer pressure. That's some of the background for a new novel gathering lots of attention by my guest, Christopher Jansma. Christopher Jansma is a lecturer at Manhattanville College and the State University of New York Purchase. He writes a monthly column for Electric Literary's blog, The Outlet. His stories have appeared in numerous publications, and it is my pleasure to welcome Christopher Jansma here to talk about his first novel, The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards. Christopher, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Great to have you here. Even though this is in the context of fiction, this is really a story to a large extent about the lies that we tell each other, the fictions that we tell each other.
Yes, yeah, that's true. It's something I thought about a lot as, you know, it's my first novel, and I was trying to figure out sort of what stories I wanted to tell. And of course, you know, as a novelist, you know, you want to make the story so exciting, you know, so that people want to read it. So the first question you start to ask yourself is, okay, well, how can I start to twist this around a little bit to make it more appealing? And so, you know, what you end up with at the end is a sort of a strange mix of lies, but also, you know, sort of deeper embedded truths, I think, in any novel.
And of course, it calls into question, as we've seen in the debate that's always raging about memoirs, what really is the truth sometimes? And is it what we remember? Is it what actually happened? And who's to say?
Yeah, and you know, I'm kind of fascinated by some of the recent studies they've done on this scientific studies about memory, and they actually say that the more often you recall a memory, the less accurate it is, because each time you recall a memory, you are recalling, you know, not really the original events, but actually the last time you recalled the memory. And so it's like a piece of data in your brain that gets overwritten over and over and over again. So, you know, over time, you know, events start to, collide in your mind. I have this happen to me all the time. I'll be telling my wife a story about, you know, oh, do you remember, you know, we went out to this restaurant and then we saw this movie and then we bumped into this friend, and she'll say those three things happened on completely separate nights. And, she has a much better memory for these things than I do. And but in a way, that's exactly what a fiction writer tries to do. That, you know, take maybe different events from different points in his life or from different people's lives, and then, you know, kind of roll them together, try to find, you know, new ways of arranging them so that again the story is interesting but also, you know, accurate maybe accurate's the wrong word, but truthful.
In many ways, it comes, I suppose, out of the same creative process. It's what kids often do is when they tell a story and the way it gets embellished over time.
Yeah, that's a good point. I when I was a kid, that was sort of the beginning of wanting to be a writer for me. Was just, you know, constantly sort of taking the reality around me and then trying to make it more exciting. And, you know, when you're a kid, you don't necessarily understand, at least I didn't, the difference between fiction and nonfiction. You know, everything's a little bit new to you, so it almost seems as if everything's being made up all the time. When I was a kid, I read, you know, voraciously all sorts of different books, you know, fantasy novels, science fiction. And, it was a long time. I think it was maybe in about seventh grade before a teacher sort of first even just explained to me that, you know, books were written by real people and that that was a job that you could have. You know, you could be a writer. And I never thought about that before. Books just existed in the world already. You know, I would go to the library and there's thousands of them. So it didn't even really occur to me that anybody actually sat down and made them. So that was the beginning of wanting to be a writer for me.
And in many ways, this story is about writing as well, and about people believing that they can write a book.
Yeah, absolutely. So the narrator of the book is a young man who wants to be a writer, he's never named over the course of the novel. But his best friend, who he meets early on in college, is a much more sort of a very talented but very unstable fellow writer named Julian, And so I think one of the most interesting parts of the first half of the book is sort of watching the two of them come up together as writers, and they're of course very jealous of one another. You know, the narrator's very jealous of his talents. I think Julian is in his own way a little jealous of the narrator's you know, sort of stability, you know, sort of watching that interplay between the two writers is really fascinating. I was just talking about this to a friend, but when I studied writing for most of my you know, college career, I studied writing at Johns Hopkins, and then I went to Columbia University and did an MFA there in fiction. And one of the, you know, sort of hard and fast rules that I would get all the time in writing workshops was that you're not allowed to write about writers. You're not allowed to write about writing because the sort of the thinking is, you know, nobody really cares about writers as much as we care about ourselves. You know, people aren't as interested in the process of how a novel gets written. They just want to read the novel. And I always thought that's, you know, that doesn't really make a lot of sense, because it's such a fascinating process, and I think there's even the process of why people would want to be, you know, come to dedicate their lives to writing is kind of a fascinating question. You know, and at the end of the day, writers are people who are seeking truth, and they're people who are trying to figure out how to, you know, tell lies or in a way trying to figure out how to sort of spin things in a certain direction. And I think that's something, you know, really universal. So I think that's what I hope this book does, is sort of, you know, help other people, you know, kind of relate to these writer characters.
It's not just about writers per se, and maybe if it, mm-hmm. if it was, that would be consistent with the idea you don't want to write, you know, inside baseball. But
right.
It's also about the experience of a reader, the idea that when we read what writers write, we don't really know what the truth is and what isn't.
Yeah.
And this really brings that out. You mentioned the narrator before. We never know the narrator's name, which also sort of sets us on edge in some respects.
Yeah. I love books with unreliable and especially sort of unnamed narrators. I teach a few in the creative writing classes that I teach. And what I love about that particular thing is that you have this novel where the narrator is pouring out his heart to you, the reader, telling you secret things that he's not telling anybody else in the story. And then, you know, but in the back of your mind, you're thinking the whole time, I don't even know this guy's name, you know, or I don't know if I can totally trust what he's telling me, or what's his agenda here, you know, why is he trying to convince me of this so much? And, you know, so that's one of the things I just find really fascinating, because then the reader is questioning as they're reading, instead of just sort of passively absorbing the entertainment that is coming at them. They're engaging with it, and I think that's one of the most sort of interesting things you can do, you know, as a writer, is try to get the reader involved a little bit in the process and sort of asking questions and flipping back.
And of course, it's even more interesting when you have characters who we never know if their life is truthful or not.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the characters, you know, in a way, to me, that it sort of brings up this greater question, which comes back to what you were asking earlier, actually. You know, what is, at the end of the day, you know, we get so attached to fictional characters and their lives. We, you know, I have classes with students, and I'm, you know, teaching a book, and we're reading, you know, about, I don't know, Holden Caulfield or something. We're doing Catcher in the Rye right now in one of the classes, and you know, the kids in the class get so upset about what happens to this character, and it's fiction. You know, they don't exist. You know, but they're devastated at the end of the book when, when, not to give anything away, but, you know, when things don't work out as well for the character, and, you know, it changes them. It's as if a real person that they knew in real life has been affected by, by this. And I think that's really the power of fiction. And at the end of the day, I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's true or not true,
right.
You know, when it's well done, you know, when you really believe that these characters exist and you feel for them.
It's like Fitzgerald describing Gatsby's life as an unbroken series of successful gestures.
Yes, exactly. And you know, at the end of course of Gatsby, you know, we find out the truth about Gatsby, and you almost wish that you didn't know. Or at least I do. I don't know
right.
when how others feel when they get to the end. But you know, the magic of Gatsby is sort of pulled back, and what we're left with is exactly that. Yeah, exactly. A series of fantastic lies that you wish you could still believe.
Talk a little bit about the scope of this novel that covers everything from North Carolina to Dubai to Sri Lanka to Ghana.
Yeah. Well, it was a lot of fun. The characters sort of travel all around the world. I wanted to write something that was both in the beginning, it sort of starts off as almost like a coming of age novel, you know, young man entering the world and beginning to figure out who he is. And then the second half of the novel becomes almost more like a sort of a picaresque or something like that, where he's sort of out in the world. He says at one point in the novel that he's not trying to find himself, that he's actually trying to get away from himself, that, you know, sort of once he's sort of come of age and figured out who he is, he doesn't like himself very much, and so he's trying to sort of to escape. And so he goes sort of wider and wider circles out into the world, trying to sort of lose himself. So he goes, originally he ends up taking a job as a teacher in Dubai, and then he goes on from there. I don't want to give things away, but he goes on from there to Sri Lanka, Ghana, Iceland, Luxembourg, all sorts of sort of fun places. For me, part of the appeal of that was just, I wanted to keep it exciting, and I wanted to write about these places. I didn't know a whole lot about all those places before I started writing, so for me it was a good opportunity to do some research and sort of find out. A lot of, you know, another sort of writing class rule that you're taught all the time is, you know, write what you know, and I find that so limiting because, you know, at least for me, I don't know that much. I'm 30 years old, and I haven't had the luxury of traveling to all these places, but I'd like to know more about them. So what better excuse to sit down and start, you know, learning all about these places.
There's also a frenetic quality to all of that travel that forces the characters to not have to confront the truth and themselves because
yeah.
they're always on the move.
Yeah, and that's the real ultimate sort of reason for the running. And that's something I think that I see. I don't know. I guess a lot of people, right now I'm about 30 years old, and I see a lot of people, I guess heading into that sort of phase at this point. You know, trying to they've sort of, you know, they've finished growing up. They've become who they are, and they're still sort of searching. And I think that's a big part of it. So they want to, you know, sort of head off into the world and see what's out there. But at the same time, sort of, you know, get away from who they are or what their life is becoming.
You know? Right. You mentioned Salinger before. I mean, in many ways, this is a coming of age story in its own right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love Salinger. I've been a Catcher in the Rye is one of those books that for me, I first read it when I was in high school. And as many people do, and I loved it then. I teach it now in my creative writing class to college students. I read it again when I was in graduate school, and I sort of assumed that, I guess I'd been told by a lot of people that, you know, it doesn't hold up. It's really just a book for teenagers. It's sort of like a young adult book. And then I read it again in graduate school in a course called Uses and Abuses of Children in Literature. And I was amazed. It just, you know, pulled back these layers and layers in the book, underneath Holden's narrative, all these secret kind of things are at work. And it's just a fascinating book. I think I've read it now 10, 12 times, and I'm always sort of discovering new things about it. So on the surface, it's sort of a coming-of-age story, like I hope my book, I think the longer time you spend with it, the more you'll sort of uncover that's happening underneath of that. The coming-of-age story is a little bit of a familiar story. We all sort of know that, you know, story from movies and from books and from our own lives. So what I find kind of interesting is to see, you know, once you're working with that scaffolding, what can you create that's sort of sort of subverts that form a little bit, messes with the model of a traditional coming-of-age story.
And this story started as a series of stories that you post, short stories that you posted online.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, so I began in 2009. I had similar, the first line of the novel is, I've lost every book I've ever written. And there's a slight autobiographical tone, truth to that, although the narrator and I are very different characters, which is something that I like to like to remind people that I'm not necessarily the same as the I in the story. But in a way that line came from truth. I had been trying to write a novel for something like 6 or 7 years, ever since I'd left graduate school. I'd been working on a novel while I was at Columbia, and it actually finished that novel and sent it out, and people weren't interested in it, so that one ended up in a drawer. And the next one, similar sort of process to it, and then I wrote a third one that didn't even get off the ground. I did finish it, but it just sort of fell apart in my hands. So I was frustrated, and I was trying to figure out sort of what I could do. And I thought maybe the best idea was to go back to basics and, try out, try to remind myself the fundamentals of storytelling. So I decided I was going to do something a little crazy and a little desperate, I guess. So in the beginning of 2009, I set up a project for myself. I called it 40 Stories. And I created a little website online, nothing fancy, just a place that my friends could go each week. And I decided that I was going to write a new story every week. I would do that for 3 weeks in a row, and then I'd take a week off and either edit or just kind of, catch my breath. And my plan was to kind of go through the whole year, and if I stayed on schedule, I would get to 40 stories by the end of the year. I wanted to do it as a way to almost kind of take the pressure off. I thought if I was just setting out to write a whole bunch of stories, then maybe it wouldn't matter as much if each one of them was totally perfect. I could just kind of have some fun with it. And it worked out really well because my friends, they didn't necessarily critique the stories or anything like that, but they were there and they would check, every week and see if there was a new story. And if for some reason I was late or if I hadn't done it, they would, send me an email and harass me about it. And some of them really, enjoyed it. It was kind of fun. It was my first kind of real readership because they would, Monday morning, they would go to their offices and, expect to see a story that they could read during their lunch break. And if it wasn't there, then they were, had questions. So, anyway, the end of the story is that about 13 weeks in, I started working on a story. I called it The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards. That story, as soon as I finished it, I just was so in love with these characters, and I realized I'm going to have to write more about them. And so the following week, I wrote another story about them, and the following week I wrote sort of another story. And then all throughout the course of the year, I would occasionally just sort of find myself coming back to those characters again and to their voices and to their story. By the time I finished the year, I had finished my 40 stories, and I think about eight of them were part of this, kind of collection. And then it took about another year after that to fill in the gaps and to sort of reorganize things and restructure things so that it read like a novel instead of just a collection of linked short stories, which I do think that that's how it will read now to people. I think it reads as a novel instead of sort of a series of stories, but the individual chapters can kind of stand on their own as well, which is kind of fun.
Christopher Jansma, his novel is The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards. Christopher, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and it was a pleasure.
Thank you.